Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Hi, I'm Juliette Selgren, and this is my podcast, The Great Antidote, named for Adam Smith, brought to you by Liberty Fund. To learn more, visit www.adamsmithworks.org. Welcome back. Recently, the world of economics lost James Gwertney, a great economist who made economics more accessible to everyone. And he did a bunch of different things. And overall, when I asked, responded by saying he was a true gentleman. So that's my bid. But today, on January 14th, 2024, I'm happy to invite Robert Lawson to talk about Gwertney and his legacy. Robert Lawson is the director of the Bridwell Institute at Southern Methodist University. Even the shorter title, and I trip over my words sometimes. For a long time, I've been told to have Professor Lawson onto the podcast, so I'm glad we're finally making it happen. I even had his daughter, Carrie Ann Lawson, on the podcast, so you should check that out as well. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Juliette. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into Gwertney and his legacy and all of that, what is the most important thing that people my age or in my generation should know that we don't?
Oh my goodness, you warned me about this question. And, you know, for an older guy like me, telling young people what they should know is a, you know, risks, what do they say these days, punching down or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. But yeah, I don't care about that here that much.
Well, okay. But so I'm a little bit reluctant to, but I did think about this a little bit because it's a tough question. It's a good question. You know, when I look at young people today, the thing that I puzzle the most about is a certain sense of entitlement that young people seem to have that, like, I didn't have growing up or at that same age. And some of that's good. Some of it's that young people, when I was young, we were told to sit down and shut up. And honestly, that was frustrating for us. And on the other hand, when you are young and you, the sense of entitlement that I've sensed, it creates demands on other people that I don't think really are very warranted. Just give you a couple examples. I had a young student the other day in class or in a workshop, and someone was said her name wrong a couple of times. And it wasn't the biggest thing, but, you know, but she got very sort of aggressively indignant toward this other person. It's like, you know, my name is, you know, and I was like, wow, that's weird. You know, people mess my name up all the time. And I have an easy name, but people call me Rob, which I don't like. And sometimes my last name is Lawson. They'll say Larson or something. And, you know, it doesn't bother me much. And if it does, maybe I'll politely say, you know, hey, my name is Bob or Robert or whatever. But sort of that aggressiveness. Now you see this in the extreme, like with, you know, with the pronoun wars now, you know, if you say the wrong pronoun towards someone. But, you know, the thing is, if you have a preferred pronoun, that's really putting a demand on other people. And, you know, and people are, you know, are going to make mistakes. You know, if you just, I don't know, Juliet, but I'm assuming you're, what is it, she, her? But if you were he, him, I,
something like
I'm
that,
I'm probably going to make that mistake. You know, I'm probably going to call you her. and that's just, it's just a mistake. It's not an attack, but a lot of people are reacting as if it was an attack. You know, the biggest example of this recently was that White House intern letter to President Biden. You know, the sort of the indignation that was like, you know, listen to us. You know, it's like, this is the president of the United States. It would have been unthinkable from when I was, you know, that age. It would have been absolutely unthinkable, whether, you know, anonymously, even to like sort of demand the attention of my boss, much less the president of the United States. So that's the, like, I guess it's sort of a like, man, everybody should like chill out. Other people are just getting through life the way you are. Everybody makes mistakes. If someone does something you don't like, it's not an attack. Pull them aside politely and say, hey, you know, I'd prefer it if you said, you know, he, him. Okay, all right, I'll try, you know. But if they don't, it's not an attack, you know. So that's kind of the old man rants. And I hope I didn't offend anyone out there, but there it is.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense because it might seem that these two things are kind of unrelated, but I think especially using an economic line of thinking, it's kind of an institution that breeds this attitude, right? There might be multiple types of ways that this has started. It might not just be pronouns or wanting to be heard or not being quiet, right? Some of these things are positive. But if you take all of them together and over time, if it kind of breeds this attitude of indignation, that's not positive. And it kind of, it makes sense following that line of thinking, that there's kind of this institution that breeds this attitude, where I'm gonna steal this idea. I'm gonna say it. I'm not stealing it because I'm gonna cite him. Ryan Chostick, if you're listening, I stole your idea, or I'm popularizing your idea or attempting to. My friend said that the way he goes about it and the way he tells people to go about the pronoun stuff is to behave like you have a food allergy in a restaurant. And it's kind of on you to make sure you don't eat anything you're not supposed to. And so if you have a preference that is outside of the norm within the restaurant, then it is your job to make it known, right? If someone mispronounces your name or gives you a nickname that you don't like, it's on you to tell them that, no, actually, that's not, I can't eat that. That's not my preference. That's not my name. And I think that that's a pretty good rule of thumb. So I really agree with what you're saying here. Yeah. So I guess without further ado, let's jump in. Can you give us a short biography, maybe an overview for those of us who don't know who James Gwortney was and some of the major feats of his career? We're going to get into some of it more deeply, but let's start with that.
Well, Jim Gwortney, we call him Jim, was, he was a Kansas farm boy and he went to a one-room schoolhouse. And it had to be, he died when he was 83, but, it had to be one of the last one-room schoolhouses left. And he said that, one of the reasons he developed a love for teaching, and that's really the biggest thing, he was a master economic educator in many different ways, was that when you're in a one-room schoolhouse, the teachers guide everyone from, first grade to eighth grade or something. And, the eighth graders end up teaching the sixth graders and the sixth graders end up teaching the, fourth graders and so forth. And so he's like, he grew up in elementary school, like teaching younger people. And it's just something that he developed in a sort of an affinity for. Then he went to Ottawa University, which is in Ottawa, Kansas, and fell under the tutelage of a gentleman named Wayne Angel. Wayne was became a Federal Reserve governor. If you think about it today, the Federal Reserve has been so crazy, popular, and everyone, we have Fed watchers and things, I think every Federal Reserve governor today is an Ivy League professor or something like that. But back in the 70s, a little professor from Ottawa University of all places in Kansas was nominated and became a Federal Reserve governor. So the Fed was back then not really the prominent institution that it is today. And then he went to grad school at the University of Washington, studied under the great Douglas North, who won a Nobel Prize. And then he went to Florida State. And, one of the really remarkable things is that Jim went to Florida State in 1969 and never left. He was a professor at FSU for 53 years, which is a remarkable thing. I mean, I'm on my fourth university myself, and he just was, he thrived there. And so Jim became a big Florida State football fan. And he was a professor and, he did his duty, published papers in top journals, American Economic Review, Journal of Political Economy. But really where he made his mark was economic education. He wrote a textbook that we can talk about. And he worked with me later on the Economic Freedom of the World Index, which was produced by the Fraser Institute or published by the Fraser Institute. Wrote a lot of popular books for the popular audience, trying to take economics to make it better in the classroom, but also to make it better, more accessible to a wide audience. So he was a first-rate scholar. I mean, full professor, 100 articles in top journals, but he also got out of the ivory tower and thought it was his mission in life to be an educator. And while I'm giving the bio, I can't not say two very important parts of Jim's life. Jim was a devout Christian. And I confess that I don't really have faith myself, but Jim was absolutely devout, and he carried his Christianity in the way that it should be carried. He was the most gracious and kind gentleman anyone ever met, and that's the thing you mentioned earlier. And the other thing is, he battled with, I think it's related to his Christianity, battled with a grace and dignity, a lot of health problems over the years. He had a serious cancer diagnosis in the 70s when he was quite a young man, still with young children, survived that. But then he had eye problems, glaucoma, which led to a series of problems. And he ended up going blind about 25, 30 years ago. So the most of the time that I knew him, he was completely blind. And it's really quite shocking that anyone could be as productive as Jim was while dealing with blindness. But he never complained, never once saw him complain about it. So that's just the overview, but we can get deeper after that.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. And I'm going to pivot slightly just out of curiosity. How do you manage to be so productive if you can't see, especially if you do research and thinking and things like that? I can't imagine. And it just, I guess, is a testament to how amazing his commitment was to educating and econ and all of that.
Well, first of all, you have to be somewhat brilliant. And Jim was absolutely that. We debate whether he had a truly photographic memory in the sort of technical sense. But I mean, literally last week before he died on his deathbed, he was talking about, you know, specific plays for the Los Angeles Dodgers in the 1950s. So he had an amazing, absolutely amazing memory. And I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. And he just could remember numbers. So when he would give presentations, PowerPoints, he would be talking and with regression tables, and he would, he would get numbers correct to the third decimal point. So he was brilliant. But obviously technology helped tremendously. You know, he mastered the talking to the computer and, you know, it'd be things like, it was amazing to watch. He would like say, open Word document in folder, Bob Lawson, you know, named, you know, Economic Freedom. And he would, and the file would open, and then he would edit. It would talk to him, and he would edit it. He would correct my typos, which was embarrassing. I'm a blind man. Correct your typos. So it's really a combination of pure genius, but also the technology. I mean, he admitted he could not have been productive or as productive without the technology. But I mean, it was so much so that I forgot frequently that he was blind. I mean, you just send him an email and with a picture, you know, like, hey, how's this graph look, Jim? And of course, you can't see the graph, right? It's absurd to ask. And but you would just forget because it was so seamless, his productivity. Mm-hmm.
Wow. I'm going to use one of my generation's favorite words. That's wild. I guess I don't know how else to respond to that.
Truly inspirational act. I mean, these are not the kind of words. I'm not a effusive kind of guy. Absolutely inspirational to watch him go through life. It was the only person I think in my life that I've like quite genuinely made me a better person, you know, just by watching him. He never said words like that, but just like, gosh, man, if this guy can survive this, I can, whatever minor foibles are going on in my life, this is nothing next to what Jim does every day.
If you could see my smile right now. All right. So you said that his work made economics more accessible. And while on the one hand, I totally believe you, my generation, when we hear professor writes a textbook, we go, that's a money-making scheme. And so can you talk to us a little bit and maybe convince my fellow peers that like what his textbook was about, how it was different from others, and what its influence was, and maybe how it actually did make economics more accessible.
Well, it's on a 17th edition. I think the first edition was 74 or something, 76 perhaps, but I think he definitely made a few dollars on it. And if you make a textbook that makes it to that many editions, you're getting a royalty check. The thing that Jim really was was the reason he wrote the textbook is he was dissatisfied with the textbooks of the era. The main textbook back then would have been Samuelson, which is very dry and technical. If you ever, God forbid, I think there's still an edition somewhere coming out, but it's not very good. I mean, it's kind of the everything. Everyone hates textbooks like that. Jim decided to make it more colorful, for example. There are certainly, it's economics. There's graphs, there's supply and demand, there's this and that. But from the very beginning, there were boxes which told like human stories, boxes on famous economists, and not just about what they did in economics, but, you know, their lives, and trying to put some context on things. And this was all fairly innovative. I think most textbooks do that now, but back then, that was kind of a new thing. The other thing I think that's important is he was trying to correct some things in the economics textbook landscape that he didn't think were correct. I mean, so for example, in the early era, the Samuelson textbook especially, the treatment was, well, markets make mistakes. There's several things that markets happen in markets that we think are bad, externalities, public goods, and then there's a solution called government for those problems. And that's in every textbook to this day. It's in Jim's textbook. But Jim wanted to add something. He said, well, but governments are flawed as well. Just like markets are flawed, governments are flawed. Governments do things that for a variety of reasons. And so what we really need to do when we think about public policy is like, well, markets fail, but governments fail. So we need to sort of figure out what's the best way to approach a particular problem. So maybe the problem is pollution. That's one of the problems that markets create. But then we need to think deeply about what the appropriate government solution to that might be. And that was something that was completely new. It's in some textbooks today now, that kind of thinking, but it was completely new. The other thing is in macroeconomics back then, there was a belief that governments could manage the macro economy. You know, we could get rid of recessions. We would just have these omniscient and omnipotent bureaucrats or Federal Reserve governors who would sort of steer the economy the way you steer a ship. And if we do it right, the old textbook said, if you do it right, we can eliminate booms and busts, and we'll just have a nice steady growth and no unemployment and all this. Well, you know, Jim was like, for the same reason I was just saying, you know, governments, Federal Reserve, they make mistakes too. They're not perfect. And so he wanted this textbook to be a little bit more realistic about the portrayal of government and government solutions. He's not anti-government by any means, but he wanted it to be like, all right, we've got market failure, and we also have government failure. Government's not a perfect solution to everything, every problem that you see in markets.
What's amazing about that is that I guess I learned economics at the college level in a post-Courtney world. Well, not post him, but post these innovations. And I see this. I can visualize exactly what these things are, like the boxes with the stories and the pictures and these kind of attempts to break away from this is just a physics textbook about the economy. And it really, that's the part of the textbook that actually makes it readable and communicates the ideas in the way that I think actual economists, for the most part, think about them. So, you know, if you haven't picked up an economics textbook in a while, pick this one up. Maybe it will look super different from what you learned with. I'm glad to live in a world that has those innovations.
I'm going to steal your physics textbook for economics. That's brilliant. a lot of them still look like that, though.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it is what they look like, which is exactly, it's like bizarre. You can compare like a math or physics textbook to certain econ textbooks, and it's a little sad. I don't know. I mean, part of it is understandable, but when you're trying to teach someone a new discipline, especially one that is not actually physics, it makes things, I think, infinitely harder if you're not I don't know. It almost predetermines how you're going to engage with the subject matter and the ways you can think about it. And I don't think economics was made to be thought of in that way necessarily, even if the tools that we have are super useful, you know?
Yeah, one of the biggest mistakes that professors make and textbook writers make is the assumption that their students are going to become just like them. And, you know, they're going to become professors of economics. And so they write textbooks, you know, designed to turn, you know, for prospective professors of economics. Well, that's, you know, almost literally zero of the people in the classroom are going to go on and become economists. And so, you know, you turn off a lot of people on economics. And as you say, economics has a lot of really valuable insights. And, you know, having economics, I think, makes you a more, you know, higher functioning human being in this world. But we start off with the assumption that they're going to be, you know, basically physicists and physics versions of economics. And that's just, it's irresponsible. It's just not true. And a lot of professors get very They get disappointed in their first few years of teaching because they're like shocked. Like, oh, my students don't care. It's like, well, you know, they don't care maybe, but your job is to make them care. And you're not going to make them care if you, you know, you start with basically graduate level equations, which is, again, a lot. Samuelson's book was example A, but there's still textbooks like that.
Yeah, I've found myself to be super lucky at UVA with this because when we teach, so I'm a teaching assistant for principles of micro and macro. And when we teach, we're instructed to teach as though the students are never going to take another class in economics. And the professors teach in that way as well. And I think that that sort of mindset is, as you were saying, very different from what the mindset usually is. But it stresses how important these principles classes are, because when you are teaching 1,000 kids a semester and then only 500 of them a year become econ majors, which is still a lot, right? It's the biggest major at our school. You're having lots and lots of kids walking away with just that. And so it just makes it so much more important. It brings it to the forefront of what you do. And I don't know. I hope it makes it better.
Well, the reason there's 400 majors at UVA is precisely because you've got such great teachers there. And UVA is well known in the world of economics as being a place with great teachers. Ken Elzing is the longtime master there, but you go to a lot of schools, you'll find they have vastly fewer econ majors. And that's because the professors are frankly terrible. They're terrible at their job of teaching. Maybe they're great economists when they're published, but they're not good at teaching.
Yeah. And I guess textbooks are like a supplement teacher or a complement teacher. I guess it depends on how good at teaching your teacher is. But I'm glad, kind of getting back on the subject, that Gortney made these changes and that we can all benefit from them today. Let's continue on this path. In your piece in the Wall Street Journal, you talk a bit about his work on Russia. And today, Russia's not super reflective of the economic values that were driven by in America or what he talked about. But how did he influence early post-Soviet Russia? And why was he even involved with that?
Well, there's two things. First of all, he was very interested in the Soviet world and when the wall fell in 1991, he took a lead from Florida State and went to Prague in 92-93. I mean, so in Prague in 92, it's former, you know, Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic then, it was rough. You know, medical doctors were driving taxis, you know, because the state had basically collapsed. He wanted to go to Czech Republic and teach free market oriented, or at least market oriented economics to students who grew up in a centrally planned economy and didn't understand anything, like basic principles of supply and demand are essentially alien to them. So he had a long time interest in central planning and central planned economies, and wanted to, you know, help you know, bring them out of that experience. And then he got involved with one of the writings with me in the Joint Economic Committee. He wrote a study with me and Randy Holcomb at Florida State. And that got the attention of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress. And he then was asked to be chief economist at the JEC. And because of that, he then was asked by Andrei Ilarionov, who was Vladimir Putin's chief economics advisor at the time. This is around 2000. When Putin was elected, I think in 99, barely took power in 2000. And so Jim and a small team of economists went, and, you know, Putin at that time, people thought was going to be a liberal reformer. He was going to continue the reforms that had been going on under Yeltsin before him. And, you know, and he talked about revitalizing the Russian economy and so forth. And so they went and gave him the spiel about how they need to liberalize and privatize and move in the direction of more economic freedom for Russia. And Putin did. I mean, the reaction was pretty quick. Within a year or so of that visit and meeting with Putin, they went to a 13% flat tax. Soviet era tax systems were extraordinarily complicated. But depending on the type of income, you could have tax rates at like 80%, you know? And so it was a very high taxed kind of regime that Putin took over. So they went to a 13% tax, and it was amazing. People instantly started, you know, opening businesses and generating income and reporting income. And it turns out the government earned more revenue at 13% than at 80%, because everyone tries to hide their income when you're being taxed at 80%. And so, but I think the point about the Russia story, it obviously failed within a matter of, I was going to say years, but maybe it's months. Within a matter of months, Putin was back on the sort of authoritarian, kleptocratic. And we now know in retrospect that Putin was kind of faking his rhetoric about, you know, moving towards freer markets was a fake. He was really trying to put the band back together, trying to get the Soviet Union back together. And it's a project that he's still working on. But yeah. I think the story for Jim is that he wasn't just content to sit in his office and write papers. I mean, almost every economist will they write papers. Oh, I got to go teach on Tuesday. So teaching's like a tax. They just want to sit in their office, write papers for other economists to read. And let's be honest, most other economists don't even read those papers. And he just wasn't satisfied. He's like, I want to make the world better. Maybe he did or maybe he didn't, but he wanted to try. And so teaching in Prague and going to Moscow and writing the textbook, all of these are examples of his reluctance to just be a normal professor who writes papers for other people that no one reads.
I will say this little anecdote that I didn't know if I was going to share it, but I think that it kind of shows that even though it didn't work in the long run, it did have an impact. And even a small impact, like the one I'm about to share, is something significant. So my friend's mom actually grew up in post-Soviet Russia. And she she worked at the Coca-Cola factory, the first one in Russia that was like ever created. And it was kind of in the wake of all of these changes. And now she lives here. But she talks about the free in those moments and how it was super productive and everyone was excited to be working. And so it had real impacts on people, even if it didn't work out in the long run. And obviously not for his fault at all. It is also just crazy that Putin is still in power, because I think we forget, because we have possibility of change every 4 years in America. I tend to forget, at least, that it is possible and a reality in some places that for more than 20 years you can have the same person in charge. So that's kind of, I don't want to say disturbing, but it is a little disturbing, I think. That A, I take that sort of thing for granted, but also that sort of thing happens in other countries.
I'm 56 years old. I think I can count five people that have ever run Russia. So Russia doesn't have any real history of, you know, 4 or 8 years and out. They've whether they were the Soviet Union or now just Russia, they really have never been able to get something like an authentic democracy off and running. It's a sad thing.
Yeah, it really is. I guess there's hope for the future, but not the immediate future by any means. All right. So after, kind of in the period, he was one of the founding co-authors of the Economic Freedom of the World Index, which I guess goes hand in hand with his interest in what was happening over there. And it's been published by more than 100 institutions, which is super successful, I think. And you've taken on the index for years now. So what does the index measure and what were its primary objectives?
So back in the 80s, there was a meeting that involved a bunch of highfalutin people like Milton Friedman and a lot of other people. And they were debating about whether freedom was getting better or worse. Freedom in every dimension, political freedom, like the freedom to vote, free speech, civil liberties, but also economic freedoms, like the freedoms to buy and sell, import and export, things like that. And there was actually disagreement amongst this sort of group of people about whether it was getting better or worse. And Milton Friedman said, you know, we should try to measure this. Like if we disagreed about how hot the room was, we would just, you know, bring a thermometer out. We would measure the temperature of the room and that would settle the debate. And, you know, the thermometer, if the mercury is rising, then it's getting hotter in the room. We just settled the debate about temperature by devising a measurement device. So the same thing for economic freedom. So Jim recruited me when I was a graduate student to begin working on the first economic freedom index. And we're trying to measure how economically free countries are. Economic freedom here means laissez-faire, free enterprise. There are a lot of different terms that get used, but it basically means keeping your governments relatively small in a fiscal sense, private property, you know, stable money and prices, free trade. Regulations that are, you know, reasonable. It's basically what you think of when you think of market countries. And so we generate and we just gather a lot of data and we use fancy mathematics like arithmetic to generate ratings. And so we now have 165 countries in our index. And it's still our index, even with Jim gone. And we, you know, Singapore is number one, Hong Kong's number two, Venezuela is 165. And we've been doing it every year since the mid 90s. We get a lot of attention from media, you know, lots of news articles. We also get a lot of attention from other academics, which is really quite gratifying since I am an academic myself. When your peers use your work, it's obviously a very gratifying thing. And so we've now got quite literally thousands of articles, published journal articles that have been written that use and cite the index. And so we've made I think the index has had a tremendous effect. But it was Jim, I mean, I was just in the early days, the helper, but it was Jim's really, it was his idea. Well, it was his set of ideas that sort of, no one knew how to do it. So Jim's like, well, let's try. And here we are.
That's awesome. So can you talk to us a little bit about the methodology that's used to compile the index and kind of about how countries are evaluated and ranked within?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we have 40 some variables now. And really there's more than 40 because some of those variables have sub variables. I've never done a proper count, actually. It's probably more like 60 or 70 numbers that we gather. And we gather numbers from like the IMF, World Bank, PricewaterhouseCoopers and a lot of other groups. And we try to score them on how consistent they are with sort of free market ideology, economic freedom. And so, for example, we capture marginal tax rates. We've talked about marginal tax rates in Russia going from 80 to 13. So in the United States, marginal tax rates at the federal level are like 48. And then, you know, in California, maybe like, if you add in the California rates, maybe it's 55 or something, 58. So in some countries, the marginal tax rates are zero. Hong Kong's is 20, but there are some countries that have no tax, like United Arab Emirates. So we score them. And so countries that have low tax rates get higher scores. And we do this for a bunch of different areas. We do it for property rights. And the property rights are really hard to measure, but there's some data, for example, on how impartial judges are. It's a survey that the World Economic Forum has done for many years. But, you know, if I were suing you in court if the judge was your second cousin, obviously I'm not going to get a fair trial, a fair judgment. So they're basically trying to measure that. And we do inflation, which acts kind of like a tax on our savings accounts, and tariffs and quotas. When I give speeches about the index, I call it the Adam Smith Index, because it's kind of a what would Adam Smith do kind of index. And Adam Smith was famous for being a free trader. So we include a whole area on tariffs and quotas and capital controls and countries without tariffs. And there are countries actually without tariffs. Singapore has no tariffs. You get better scores. So we basically have the raw data that comes in from a whole range of different sources. And then we just algebraically convert it to sort of 0 to 10 number scale. And 10 means more economically free, 0 means less. And then we just average it all up, got an index. It's pretty, in a lot of ways, it's pretty low tech. There's not a lot of highly sophisticated statistical analysis. It's just, grab the number, apply a simple arithmetic formula, take an average, rinse and repeat. The simplicity of it actually is a feature because a lot of our users are journalists and policymakers, politicians. And if it was really complicated, statistically complicated, I think they would be turned off because they would look at it as kind of a black box. Our index is quite transparent. You could open up the report, Julian, it should be, if we've done our jobs right, I think we have, you should be able to exactly, back out where every number came from, how the numbers got derived.
What are some of the notable trends that you've observed over the years, with respect to the index, and especially relating to the United States?
Good question. One thing is we absolutely do see in our data the general move towards economic freedom that began, I think, in the 80s. You think of the 80s, at the beginning of the 80s, Reagan and Thatcher, and both countries moving away from their, in England's case, especially moving away from almost socialism. But even the United States, under Nixon, we had wage and price controls. We're talking seriously about industrial planning. But anyway, Reagan and Thatcher came along and they steered their countries pretty sharply back away from, government control of the economy towards more market. And it's reflected in our data. But the interesting thing is it's not just the United States and the UK. All across the world, the 80s and the 90s were a period of moving towards liberalism. And I use liberalism in the correct sense, not the corrupted American sense, moving towards more liberal open markets. Tariffs went down all over the world, the general agreement in tariffs and trade, GATT, which became the WTO. I mean, it was a worldwide phenomenon to get rid of tariffs, to privatize government enterprises, to lower tax rates like was done in Russia, but it was done in lots of places. One example, it's in the index, is we have conscription, military conscription as part of our index. And I mean, military conscription is like the ultimate tax. Like, the government taxes 100% of your labor and makes you work for them instead of wherever you might want to work.
That's a brutal way to put it.
Yeah, well, it is. And so
it's accurate.
One of the great things is the conscription is almost, it's not gone away, but, and I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it was something like 50% of the countries back in the 70s had conscription. And the U.S. had conscription. And then now it's like 14% or some much lower number. There's been a move in many dimensions across many countries. So that's the biggest trend. And you see that in the 80s and 90s. I will admit it's leveled off somewhat in the 2000s and 2010s and up until today. But it's still increasing. The global average is increasing. They're still moving towards liberalization, not so much in the U.S. anymore, but in Africa, in parts of Asia, you're seeing really still strong movements towards more free markets. Now, with respect to the United States, though, the United States is a little bit of an oddball because we did liberalize on, you know, Reagan, and then, you know, in Clinton, we had budget surpluses, amazingly today when you think about it. But that mostly ended by about 2000. From 2000 forward, the U.S. has actually been going down our economic freedom index. It's down to sixth in the rankings, but some of that's because almost everybody in the top is going down as well. So again, it's kind of a global trend at the top. Think about what's happened in the United States since 2000. We've fought wars on, you know, terrorism. We've accelerated the war on drugs in many ways. We're now fighting a war against illegal immigration, apparently. We're just fighting wars upon wars upon wars, and spending that's associated with that. And also the regulations that are associated with that, financial regulations, many of them well-intended maybe to fight terrorists, but those regulations are extremely costly. And so our index for the U.S. has gone down modestly, but it's gone down. It's one of the few countries, really, that's gone down, as most are still increasing somewhat much slightly. I don't want to exaggerate it. The U.S. is still one of the freest economies in the world relative to most. We have less taxes and regulations than most. But, 2000 was kind of the high watermark for the U.S. and for lots of countries. You'll see most of the high income countries sort of peaked around 2000 and kind of got a slow decline since.
Do these trends worry you, or are you optimistic?
When I was younger, I was much more pessimistic, weirdly, than I am today, which I think goes against the trend. I think usually goes the other way, but as you age. But part of the reason is because the more I study the rest of the world, the more I realize, not that it couldn't be better. I would really wish it was better in the U.S. But, I mean, it's really quite special. The United States has been able to sustain not just a fairly high-functioning liberal democracy. Maybe it's not as perfect as we would like, as we sometimes see, but a high-functioning liberal democracy, but also a high-functioning market economy. We've been able to hold that together for a long period of time, and that's pretty special. And that gives me optimism that for the United States for the future. We're now basically, in terms of economic freedom index, we're now basically where we were in 1970 in terms of the index. But, in 1970, people would have predicted liberalism that took off in the 80s and 90s. So maybe the 2030s and 2040s will be another period of liberalization. I suspect it will be, actually. And that gives me optimism. The rest of the world is pretty messed up in lots of ways. The taxes are higher, the regulations are higher, the property rights are weaker. Their monetary systems, like Argentina, they're disasters. It's not as good as I'd like, but it's not bad in context, and that keeps me an optimist. It's easy to get pessimistic in the short run. You just see, Donald Trump or Biden or whoever. You just see candidates for office that you just think are terrible. I do mostly, but if you step back from that, look at the big trends, it's not bad. The world is actually vastly better off in almost every way today than it was when I was your age. The world's richer, far fewer poor people. We're freer. There are more democracies. In the last few years, it's been a little rough, I'll admit. But, over the longer trend, it's pretty good. And I think this is just a hiccup. Well, ask me in 30 years. I'm still alive.
I wish we could keep talking about all of this, but I have one final question for you. But first, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about Jim and his legacy and all that you've done to maintain and uphold his work, and for putting it kind of concretely somewhere in a podcast and in the Wall Street Journal and other places. So thank you. What is one thing that you believed at one time in your life that you later changed your position on, and why?
Well, first, thank you. I'm pleased to be able to honor Jim. A lot of people have been patting me on the back for the Wall Street Journal article and all the things I've written about Jim last week. And that's, but it's not me, and I'm getting a little emotional, forgive me. But, you know, he's impacted so many lives. I mean, my inbox is just filled with testimonials from former students and friends who, and I just wanted to give them a voice and you know, remember a great man. I thank you for the opportunity. Now, to your question, you know, also a difficult question. It's a great question. You know, I can't really think of a discrete aha moment where like 5 minutes before I thought A and then 5 minutes later I thought B. It wasn't like, you know, but certainly over time, if I think about the things I thought when I was in my 20s versus what I think now that I'm in my 50s, I think one thing that really is different is voting. When I turned 18, literally on my 18th birthday, I drove down to the post office and I proudly filled out my voting registration card. I was so excited. I was finally 18. I was going to be able to vote. I got to college. I was a college Republican president. I thought I was going to go to law school. I ended up going to econ PhD, but I was very interested in politics, and voting was something that I was proud to do. And then I did it for a few years, and then I started to realize I wasn't looking forward to election day. I didn't like it. I would like go vote, and I would come out with a bad feeling, like I just did something dirty. You know, like I looked at the candidates, I'm like, I don't like any of these people, and I didn't feel good about it. And then I sort of made a decision to stop, and it turned out like. Was a great decision. I just stopped voting. And it was because I just didn't like voting. So, you know, one of the beautiful things about being an adult is if you don't like something, you just don't have to do it. That's what it means to be an adult. I don't have to finish my piece. I don't have to vote. You know, it's my choice. But in the last few years, I've gotten even more strident about my view towards voting, and people will probably hate this. Listen, but I almost think it's evil now to vote. I'm not calling people who vote evil, but voting is a way of making decisions collectively. And there are some things we have to make collectively. Like we have to decide where the sewer is going to go. And that's a collective decision. We're not going to have 10. We can't let every household decide where the sewer goes. It's ridiculous. We're going to have one sewer and we're all going to share it. And if we need to elect a sewer commissioner to make that, that's fine. Like making decisions collectively for decisions that should be collective makes sense. But so much of what we're deciding nowadays is how one group of voters can gore the ox of another group of voters. Like we're collectively deciding whether these two dudes can get married. There's nothing about whether these two guys can get married that's a collective decision. Like, that's not my, I mean, what do I have to do with that decision? That's their decision. There's something inherently collective about whether two guys get married or two women get married. There's nothing inherently collective about how we pay for, like, we now vote on whether how much money my neighbors have to spend to educate my kid. Well, you know what? It's not really my neighbor's job to educate my kid. So much of voting is about Group A trying to make Group B do something or not do something that they, you know, do something they don't want to do or not do something they do want to do. I just think telling people what to do or what not to do is wrong. And that's what most of what we vote on. I don't know if it's 80%, 90% or 95%, but most of what voting is now is about electing people who are going to tell other people how to live their lives or how not to live. I don't want to participate. I'm out. I'm not calling people evil who vote because I think they're all well-intentioned. But I'm increasingly of the opinion that it's just wrong to even participate in the political process, given that it's mostly about telling other people what to do. And I'm just sort of a conscientious objector now.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guests for their time and insight. I'd also like to thank you for listening to the Great Antidote podcast. It means a lot. The Great Antidote is sound engineered by Rich Goyette. If you have any questions, any guests, or topic recommendations, please feel free to reach out to me at greatantidote@libertyfund.org. Thank you.